It is 5 p.m. and this is IC Radio. So for everything we do, we get inspiration from something else. Creating is all about taking old ideas and applying them in a brand new context. But can we also find this inspiration from nature around us? I'm Jackie Wakefield, your iScience radio editor. Rena is producing the show. And today I'm joined in the studio by Kenna Castleberry, the iScience web editor and general plant nerd.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah. And also we're joined by Harry Jenkins, our iScience news editor.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. So today we're talking botany and medicine. Are animals that different from us? And whale fins and bird beaks, body parts or feats of engineering? We've also got an interview with Dr. Kamaljit Singh, and he thinks that we can learn a lot from termite mounds. So stay with us between now and 6 p.m. right here on IC Radio. But first off, Harry, our iScience news editor, is going to give us the news roundup for the week. Take it away, Harry.
Thank you, Jackie, and welcome everyone to the first Science News Roundup on IC Radio this academic year. It's been a big week for science, as the 2019 Nobel Prizes for Physics, Chemistry, and Physiology or Medicine have now all been awarded. So let's have a look at who and what won. Firstly, the way cells adapt to changing oxygen levels claimed the first prize for Physiology or Medicine. William Kaelin Jr., Sir Peter Ratcliffe, and Greg Semenza were all jointly awarded the prize for the research that revealed the mechanism behind one of life's most essential adaptive processes. We've always known for centuries how important oxygen is for life, but thanks to this work, we actually know how varying oxygen levels regulate essential processes. And this isn't just useful for how humans adapt to living altitude, for example, but it's also paved the way for promising new strategies to tackle different diseases, including cancer and anemia. Then, moving on to physics, two very different types of discovery were honored this year, but both gave new perspectives on our place in the universe. The water split between James Peeble, whose work showed us that we have no idea what 95% of the universe is made of, aka dark matter, and Michael Meyer and Didier Queloz, who discovered the first ever exoplanet, aka a planet outside our solar system. Both of the discoveries led to revolutions in their fields. Peeble's work is now the basis of our modern ideas of the universe, and now there have been over 4,000 exoplanets discovered ever since that first one. Moving on to chemistry, last but not least, this winner may now be commonplace, but it's changed our world and potentially saved our future. The lithium-ion battery is lightweight, powerful, and rechargeable, and used globally for portable electronics. The ability to store that energy also means that they're foundation of fossil fuel-free future. A lot of Fs there. Three men are credited for the introduction to this to our world. Stanley Whittingham, who laid foundations and the first, if unstable and slightly explosive, lithium-ion battery. John Goodenough, who built upon this work, made it a bit more powerful. And finally, Akira Yoshino, who then actually went on to make the first commercially viable lithium-ion battery in 1985. And talking about this, food for thought, you may have noticed that all these winners of 2019 Nobel Prizes are men. Whilst last year both chemistry and physics went to women, it seems it might have been a bit of a blip on their record. Only 20 science Nobel laureates out of roughly 600 have been women since the inception of the prizes. Some may argue that the current winner is a reflection of the science landscape of a few decades ago, when few women were actually in science. However, a study has shown that even when factoring this in, they're still heavily underrepresented. And this doesn't even touch on Western bias, which is obvious from a quick look at the demographics. Whilst the Nobel Prizes are highly respected and influential, do they need to do more to reflect the modern scientific landscape, if they're to remain relevant, if they even are relevant still? And that's all for this week. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks, Harry. Yeah, I literally, like, when you were reading out all of the names, I was like, men.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So why do you think, like, who actually awards the Nobel Prize? Like, why is it kind of stuck in the past like it is? I don't actually know a lot about the whole award ceremony, to be honest.
I think, you know, there is a lot of money in awarding Nobel Prizes, and it could be some of it is, you know, financially motivated or politically motivated.
Well, that is a scary thought, which brings us to our first song of the day, which is by Big Scary. So this is, song is called The Opposite of Us from the album Organism.
Mm-hmm. chemicals. I forgot to say, I just say something dumb anyway. And everything is the lay that gets in between us. And every kiss is a counting time to the next one. This time we're under the sheets, and really, baby, I wanna make something else, something new, something different, something with you. Missing the man when it's time to stand up. I feel the pressure like I hear music. I'm only doing the best I can, the best I can. I am trying the best I can.
That was Big Scary with Opposite of Us, and that was off their album Organism. And speaking of organisms, one of the most important organisms in our world are plants. Kenna, you're going to tell us all about how we use plants for medicine.
I will definitely try. So my background is in English and botany as an undergraduate, and I served as the first medicinal plant intern at the Denver Botanic Gardens in Colorado, where I'm from. So I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but I've definitely done quite a bit of research. And I think medicinal plants, if we're thinking of where we can pull from nature, is something that seems pretty self-explanatory, but yet is still controversial in most of our modern medicine societies. And what I found to be most interesting about why it's a controversy is the sense that when you look back on medicinal plant research and medicinal plant documentation, a lot of the research uses and documentation of medicinal plants is from women and non-white ethnicities, which seems to be saying something a little bit about how the scientific community does accept medicinal plant use as a science. So I'll give you one example of a medicinal plant. Well, I'll actually give you two examples. One example of a medicinal plant that has been well integrated into our society and one that isn't. And you can kind of see the difference between the two. So the one that has been well integrated in our society is the willow bark, which has salicylin in it, which is similar to aspirin. So, you know, the Native Americans would use willow bark to really help numb pain and injuries and wounds, just peeling the bark right off the tree and putting it right on whatever was, you know, hurting or ailing them. And of course, you know, some scientist about 50 years after that found the Native Americans doing that, asked why, started asking those questions, and sooner or later found the salicylin complex, found the aspirin complex, and was able to actually make aspirin. So that's one, you know, medicinal plant that has over the years been able to be pulled out of that non-white ethnicity background into our current society and considered a science for
right.
use.
But yeah. I guess in that context it was only accepted after a presumably white man, European, went in
right.
and
right.
proved it as such.
Yeah. So, like, one plant that's still controversial in its usage is rue. It's from kind of the Mediterranean area. You'll find it in a lot of Mediterranean dishes as spices. But, you know, historically, rue has been used as almost a natural contraceptive. So it helps bring about miscarriages, abortions, as well as lower sperm motility. So you can guess that, you know, over the centuries and centuries of its use, it's been used by women mainly. So, you know, but you don't hear about rue today being used by women as a natural contraceptive.
No.
So it is something that's, you know, clearly medicinal plant usage is still a work in progress. It's still, you know, needing some time, some more research to get accepted by the scientific community. But that is one of those stories of hopefully it gets there.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, do you know of any, have any scientists looked at rue? Like, is that a place that people are starting to explore, or is it just kind of completely ignored by the scientific community?
I think rue, it's really hard because when you're talking about medicinal plants, you obviously have to bring in big pharmaceutical companies to the argument. And I think rue is one of those plants that probably won't get touched because we already have pharmaceuticals making birth control pills or contraceptives or something like that that work maybe more effectively than rue would naturally.
Yeah.
It's one of those cost things as well. It could be more expensive to grow a bunch of rue and cultivate it into some sort of pill or supplement as opposed to just a natural, or not natural, but a synthesized birth control.
Yeah, I guess just like adding onto that, sorry, I don't mean to take us off on a tangent, but I mean, lately there has been a lot of like controversy as far as like women's mental health and things like the pill and injecting different hormones and people's reaction to it. And a bit of research is just starting to come up with like, maybe like we don't actually know what we're putting in our bodies. So who's to say like
absolutely
that rue couldn't be another viable option potentially?
I think in that regard, absolutely. Rue hopefully should get touched to, you know, see if it is better then, you know, synthesize contraceptives. And maybe it turns out that we're wrong all along. Who knows?
Yeah. Where was it used, actually? Like, was it just used in those, like, Mediterranean countries? Was it used more widely?
No, it was used more widely across Europe. It's actually been featured in a couple of Shakespeare plays, like Hamlet and Richard II. So it has gotten a name in literature and history a little bit. But it is one of those plants that when you're talking about medicinal plants, people aren't going to, you know, automatically say, oh, rue, I've used that before.
Yeah, true. Interesting. So, yeah, so is that, so do you think like the main reason, once again, that that maybe hasn't been as explored is because one, it is like a women's health thing, and two, it was also like discovered and
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, so one of the more traditional plants, I think, just to change the subject as far as talking about something more local here, that people are going to be more familiar with, because I don't think everybody has seen rue, is the yew tree, Y-E-W. So that's used in a lot of hedges here, clearly. Like I went up to Warwick Castle a couple weekends ago and it was just lining all the hedges. And the only reason I knew it was yew is because it has these little red berries on it. So, you know, it clearly it's very, what do I want to say? Like it's made its way into English society very well. But yew is a very medicinal plant. It's used a lot for, you know, starting or what should I say? Stopping cell division. So, yeah, interestingly enough, Dame Agatha Christie, of course, one of, you know, the best writers from this region, in my opinion, actually used yew as a murder weapon to murder off one of her victims in the book Pocket Full of Rye. So the victim, I can't, of course, give any spoilers.
Yeah, please don't.
But the victim, you know, takes this compound that Christie rightly, you know, did her research and found was taxine, which taxine comes from the leaves of yew. Or the yew tree.
So it's not the berries.
It's not the berries. The berries themselves are poisonous as well, but the entire tree is poisonous.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah. So you can take the berries or the leaves. This character took the leaves, and you know, yew works very, very quickly as stopping cell growth and as a poison that you get seizures, really bad, like walking gaits, and then you just end up dying. But the nice thing about it being a medicinal plant, yeah, you wouldn't think it'd be a medicinal plant, right? Yeah,
the nice thing about it.
I know. The nice thing about it being a medicinal plant. No, the reason it is a medicinal plant is because it actually does stop cell growth. And so scientists today have started using the compounds in yew to help with tumor growth and to stop tumor growth. So taxine is now used in Taxol or paclitaxel. Those are kind of the two big pharmaceutical medicines used in chemotherapy.
Okay.
Yeah, so
it is a form of chemotherapy.
It
still
is. Yeah, it okay. is a form of chemotherapy, and it's used for ovarian cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer, and it's very effective. So, you know, this medicinal plant that, you know, is poisonous, clearly, you know, people shouldn't touch it, that sort of thing, is actually used to help in cancer research. And a lot of medicinal plants are ending up that way as more and more scientists are looking into how can we help with cancer, how can we help with cancer recovery.
Yeah.
So it could be the big breakthrough for medicinal plants.
There you go. So it's like the ones that would be most useful as far as cancer treatment goes would be the ones that stop, like inhibit cell growth, as you said.
I think so. A lot of other medicinal plants are actually being used in cancer recovery. So, you know, aromatherapy, relaxation, that sort of thing can really help. And a lot of medicinal plants are good at helping with cell growth as well. So a lot of your face washes and face soaps will have things like calendula in them or aloe, and both of which can help stimulate cell growth. So I think, you know, if you think of like a chemotherapy patient who may have lost all their hair, you know, that's something that they could look into as far as trying to help their body naturally get back to a good state.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, using those like plant remedies or like natural remedies, I suppose. Like it's interesting. I was listening to a podcast the other day all about oils and like herbal remedies. Mm-hmm. So I kind of looked into that for a while because I had like tummy problems, and I heard peppermint oil was kind of like the thing to use. So I looked into all this research, and apparently that's like the only one of those like lavender or any of those kinds of things that actually has like research behind it to actually help with that thing. So yeah, it's interesting the ones that, but it's really like not because they don't help, like it's just because there's no research behind
there's
it
no
as
research.
You said.
Yeah. I think the other thing too is medicinal plants, it's the whole, you know, research subject of that and the whole category of medicinal plants is a great way to bring culture back into science. Because, you know, if you have a scientist who is researching a medicinal plant, you would hope that they would be like, okay, where was this plant originally used and how was it originally used? And they'd have to go back to either the native people who use that plant, so Native Americans and willow bark, or, you know, back to an original medieval text or, you know, some sort of anatomy textbook from the 1500s. Something like that to help them learn how the plant was originally used so that they can then use that to shape their research to go forward.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
I think
there's like so much in like folklore and things that people do things for a reason. Like
exactly.
People just don't need to investigate it fully.
Yeah. Well, like once again, like sorry to keep bringing in other things, but like I read this article about how important it is to like engage like people who may not have like scientific backgrounds in science. Like there was one example where I think a bunch of archaeologists found this old building, like a ruin, and in the middle of the ruin they had like it was like a circle of bricks, and they're like, wow, what did these ancient people use these bricks for? And they spent like 2 years trying to figure it out. And then they went and chatted to a few locals and they were like, oh, we still have that. That's our chicken coop. So, like, years wasted. Yeah. Wow. And like, it was the same with, I think they found a smithing tool, which is still used in the exact same context today. But once again, like, so much time wasted trying to research what this old tool could be, when in reality, like, people are using it every single day. Yeah. And as you said, like, Indigenous people are the experts and they've been using things in these ways, and that's such a good first point of call to go when it comes to sort of trying to find new medicines and new discoveries generally, I think.
Yeah, I think when you're pulling from nature, it's one of those you can easily overlook just the simplicity of how things work in nature, because yes, nature can be really complicated, but you know, if you overthink that, you're gonna miss so much.
Oh god, yeah. Yeah. Once again, like, what is it, the Occam's razor, where it's like,
mm-hmm. Oh yeah, simplest answers.
Occam's razor, yeah.
Yeah.
Keep it simple, stupid is how we how we say it in the state.
I think we had a more complicated one. It was something like the answer with the least assumptions is usually the right one. Yeah.
Honestly, keep it simple, stupid.
I like
much
that
easier to remember.
Well, let's keep it simple by going to the next song. So we've been talking all about nature, and to be honest, I'm starting to miss nature and I would love to go for a lakeshore drive. So let's listen to Lakeshore Drive by Aliotta James Jeremiah.
Down from rats on up to riches, 15 minutes you can fly. Pretty blue lights along the way help you ride on by, and the blue lights shining with a heavenly grace help you ride on by. And there ain't no road just like it anywhere I found. Running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town, and just slipping on by on LSD, Friday night trouble bound. Then it starts up north from Hollywood, water on the driving side, concrete mountains rearing up, throwing shadows just about five. Sometimes you can smell the green if your mind is feeling fine. There ain't no finer place to be than running Lakeshore Drive. And there's no peace of mind the place you see riding on Lakeshore Drive. And there ain't no road just like it anywhere I found. Running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town, just slipping on by on LSD, Friday night trouble bound. This Friday night and you're looking clean, too early to start the rounds. A 10-minute ride from the Gold Coast back makes you show your pleasure bound. And it's 4 o'clock in the morning and all the people have gone away. Just you and your mind at Lakeshore Drive, and tomorrow is another day. And the sun shines fine in the morning time, tomorrow is another day. And there ain't no road just like it anywhere I found. Running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town, and just snaking on my own LSD, finding that trouble bound.
Ah, oh, that was such a fun song. So that was Lakeshore Drive by Aliotta James Jeremiah. Apologies if I'm absolutely butchering that name. So we've been able to gain a lot from the world around us, according to Kenna and our medicinal plants. And without our close relationship with plants, we wouldn't have so many of the amazing things we have today, such as coffee, medicines, even rubber comes from plants. But how about animals? Us harvesting from plants and using them to inform our world seems pretty logical. Like, take a log cabin, for example, that's just built out of the nature around us. But what have we learnt from the animal kingdom, which changed the way we do things? So before we get into all of the amazing things we've taken from the animal kingdom, we wanted to talk about how we actually relate to animals. For example, a study done by some scientists in America found that humans felt more empathy towards dogs getting hurt than they did adult humans. It was the same amount of empathy towards dogs that they felt towards a human child. So just put that in perspective. Wow. The scientists said this makes sense in light of previous research in which human mothers were subjected to MRI scans of their brain while they looked at pictures of their own children, other children, their own dog, and an unfamiliar dog. In that research, it was found that the brains of the mothers tended to respond in a similar manner to both dogs and kids. So, sorry kids, but looks like the family dog might be on the same level as you. And actually it makes sense because my mum actually calls me by my dog's name all the time.
Mine does too. Yeah. Mine does too.
So I get it, mum. You like my dog as much as me. That's okay. She is much cuter than me.
Mums aren't cat people.
Sorry, cats as well, apparently. So the scientists also said that they were surprised by the interaction of age and species. Age seems to trump species when it comes to eliciting empathy. In addition, it appears that adult humans are viewed as capable of protecting themselves, while full-grown dogs are just seen as larger puppies. So that could kind of bring in, like, I mean, yeah, like helping the helpless, I guess, kind of thing.
Sure.
But also, dogs are a lot cuter than humans.
Dogs are a lot
cuter.
That is true. They're also a lot more emotional, I find. I know as far as animal emotions, there's this great book I read a couple of years ago called How Animals Grieve by Barbara King. It's a very hard book to read, but it's really, really fulfilling.
Why is it a hard book to read, just out of interest?
She goes through different case studies of different animals and how they're going through the grieving process. So a lot of the animals she picked were mammal-like animals, so more of our closer relatives in evolutionary terms. So she went through a case study of dolphins where mothers had lost their calves, but they would, you know, try to revive the dead calves by pushing them up to the surface and then pushing them down and over again until the bodies ended up just rotting away. So she also talks about elephant mothers trying to drag the dead babies around. And yeah, it was a very hard read, but it was one of those, you know, she clearly is making the argument that our human emotions come from somewhere animalistic, which a lot of people think emotions are what separates us from animals. But it turns out, not really. Animals have emotions too. It's just harder because they don't speak our language. So it's hard to communicate with both animals and humans together. So I know pets too are the other big ones that end up grieving. So dogs can grieve over the loss of a fellow dog or cat by sleeping in the area the dog or cat was sleeping in, or, you know, trying not to eat. So a lot of pet owners, what they end up doing when a dog loses, you know, a fellow sibling, is they end up getting another pet so that the older dog has company, you know, can keep busy. And
yeah.
I mean, who doesn't love puppies, right?
God, yeah. Well, right? We just learned everyone loves puppies.
I know, clearly. So, yeah. So it's really nice to kind of see that emotional level play out in animals and the interaction with humans as well, and kind of how we fit into the bigger picture as far as evolution. And to know that emotions have grown through the tree of life just like the rest of us.
Yeah, well, I guess it kind of brings up the question, like, what role does that emotion actually play? Mm-hmm. Like, in an evolutionary perspective, like
why was that selected for? What was the importance of having that emotional connection?
Yeah, exactly. Like, right. It kind of makes me wonder, like, or is grief kind of almost the bad gene that comes along with being able to form close actions?
Like a mutation in a sense?
Yeah, like, you know how there's...
trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah, where you probably be able to say, oh, it's great that you can form this really strong connection. Mm. But the downside is you get this really bad emotion if it gets severed.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I think the other thing, though, too, with grief is, you know, it tells a parent or it tells a, you know, parental animal that you have to care for your kids. The whole biological imprinting thing is, you know, you're just attached to them.
Oh, so it's almost like a consequence of not, of almost like failing your reproductive output.
Yeah, I think so.
I get like, you don't want to feel grief, do you?
Oh.
Protect your child.
Protect your child, yeah. I think so.
Oh, that's such a good point, actually. And like, as you were saying that as well, I was kind of thinking like, yeah, like what actually does separate us from other animals? Like, right. Really, like, because something that's always seen as human and human stories is exploring our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But turns out it's actually not just for humans. It's for the whole plethora of species and mammals and potentially other animals, right, as well. It'd be interesting to see more case studies come out about reptiles or birds or even insects.
Yeah, more going to be like cold animals.
Yeah, right. I'd be so intrigued by that. But now it's time for our next song. So we've been talking about all different animals. So let's go to the jungle with the song Happy Man.
I'm a troubled man, changed by the things I do. True, but it's funny how they all remember you. And I could be different, times to do something new. But giving everything on to be a happy man. So, gotta understand, blamed by the friends I lose. Who's getting out of hand? Do you think they depend on you? And I could be different, trying to do something new. But giving everything.
That was Jungle with Happy Man. Let's carry on with the show for now. So, yeah, we talked about, like, how we relate to animals, and it turns out they're not actually that different from us, and animals are pretty damn ingenious. So what can we actually learn from them as far as how they live our lives and what can we apply to our lives, which actually is called biomimicry. So biomimicry is a process of finding sustainable solutions to problems by using patterns from nature. There's kind of like two concepts of biomimicry. So the first is that it's seen as like a technology transfer from nature to humanity. And the second concept of imitation or mimicry is further divided into two, is divided into the two perspectives. But the second perspective is productively supplementing what is in nature with the hopes of actually making it better. So we have two reasonably recent and super interesting examples of biomimicry which have occurred and have actually been very successful. So the first one was that marine scientists have long suspected that humpback whales' incredible agility comes from the bumps on the leading edges of their flippers. So at the moment, Harvard University researchers have come up with a mathematical model that helps explain this hydrodynamic edge. The work gives a theoretical weight to a growing body of empirical evidence that similar bumps could lead to more stable aeroplane designs, submarines with greater agility, and turbine blades that can capture more energy from this wind and water. So why is this? So the advantage of the humpback whale flipper seems to be the angle of attack that it's capable of. So the angle of attack is the angle between the flow of the water and the face of the flipper. So when this angle of attack of a whale flipper or an aeroplane wing becomes too steep, the result is something called stall. In aviation, stall means there isn't enough air flowing over the top of the surface of that wing. This causes a combination of increased drag and lost lift, a potentially dangerous situation that can result in a sudden loss of altitude. Previous experiments have shown, however, that the angle of attack of a humpback whale flipper can be up to 40% steeper than that of a smooth flipper before stall occurs. The researchers also found that the amplitude of the bumps play a greater role than the number of bumps along the flipper's leading edge. So the idea is, if you make an aircraft that's much harder to stall and easier to control, says the scientist, for example, fighter jets could be designed to be more acrobatic without risk of stall-induced crashes. And in the water, it could make submarines even more nimble. So the same logic can be applied to wind turbines, allowing nearly double the amount of wind power to be captured, which is pretty incredible. So the turbicles effectively channel the airflow across the blades and create swirling vortices that enhance lift. Another example is bullet trains. So bullet trains in Japan are bloody awesome, but as it turns out, they're also really loud. Not very surprisingly, going 300 kilometer tends to wake up people and disturb the wildlife. But luckily, one of the train engineers was not just an engineer. He was also an avid bird watcher. So he observed the kingfisher dive into the water and be able to come right out without a single noise. So he had the idea of kind of replicating the beak and then making this same shape on the front of the train. And voila, no more noise.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. So many examples of this where we've kind of taken these ideas from animals or their structure and been able to apply it in ways that have been really beneficial for our society, which is very cool and one of my favorite topics. But like, I think it's just like very cool just be able to like look at things in nature. Like the engineer just did bird watching in his free time and that could aid him in his career. And it kind of almost brings us back to the medicinal plants. Like it's almost the same thing, like going to places that aren't from our own discipline and aren't from a traditional place and still get inspiration from that.
Right. Absolutely. Mm. I mean, inspiration knows no bounds.
Yeah, exactly.
It could go anywhere.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know, like, do you guys have any other examples? Do you know of any other cases where this sort of stuff has happened?
Spider silk, because of its tensile strength.
Yeah.
I think like its tensile strength is meant to be stronger than steel, and trying to replicate the actual structure, but in like massive proportions to make structures which are like really, really strong, but flexible at the same time.
Oh my God. What kind of structure do you reckon that would apply well to?
Elevators?
Yeah, I was going to say elevator, like ropes.
Oh,
and all of course all those James Bond spy movies.
Oh, of course,
where he needs like
Nieces and
nephews. Oh, of course, to go up the buildings.
Oh, yeah. Well, James Bond, he needs more. He needs more gear, doesn't he?
Apparently.
Get what's her name? M.
M.
Is it M?
Yeah.
Who does all the?
Oh, Q. Oh, Q. Q, oh, no, does the
Q. Oh God, I'm so sorry. My James Bond knowledge is terrible. No, oh well, get Q on it. Get Q onto the spider silk.
Well, yeah.
I mean, even speaking of silk, silkworms with
clothing.
Clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the big one for me though is like, I don't know if you've seen the Fibonacci spirals.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And those come from seashells and snail shells. You know, it's this perfect spiral that nature has perfected over.
They're kind of on everywhere. Isn't it also in like sunflower seeds?
It's in sunflower seeds as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, really?
Flowers itself, they all have that same spiral
golden
shape.
Golden ratio.
The golden ratio. Yeah, exactly.
So is. You'll have to help me with that. Fibonacci's, what's it called?
It's Fibonacci's sequence. It's a mathematical sequence to make the perfect spiral.
Oh.
And Leonardo da Vinci used it quite a bit.
Yeah.
In some of his drawings, like especially his flying machine drawings. But it's this, you know, beautiful spiral shape that's found in nature that, you know, clearly did not get made up by anybody.
So we're able to use that just in like, ooh, artichokes as well. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's why they're such a pleasing vegetable.
Especially with some butter.
Oh my God, yum. I'll stop. Like, did you hear my stomach rumbling before? Oh, man. Man, that's crazy. So, like, we pretty much have gained, like, lots of inspiration artistically from nature, but with a mathematical model.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That intersect. Oh, amazing. Yeah. So, like, oh, I love that. So you've got, like, the science side of things with the mathematical model. You've got nature. You've got art. Combine them all together. You get Fibonacci's sequence.
And you can just... It's one of those, you know, it's fun for everybody.
Fun for the whole family.
Fun for the whole family. You got your math people. You got your science people. You got your
flying machines. You got the Renaissance paintings. Yeah, using golden ratios.
So was the... What was it that you said? The... your golden ratio, is that calculated from Fibonacci's sequence?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah,
I know it's it's in a lot of old paintings.
Mm.
They did a documentary on it, or was it in the Da Vinci Code or something?
It was probably in the Da Vinci Code.
Because the Mona Lisa was made with was the Mona Lisa made with a golden sequence? Or am I just making that up?
I know a lot of Leonardo's work does have the golden sequence in it. I don't know if that particular painting does or not.
Well, we might fact check that and come back after the break with an answer for everyone. But yeah, before that, let's go to the next song and hopefully we have a bit more success playing the full song this time. But if not, we'll still be feeling okay because we've got Feeling Good by Nina Simone.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. A new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun. You know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done. That's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. And all the power.
Oh, what an absolute queen. So that was Feeling Good by Nina Simone. So we just talked about biomimicry and all of the different things that we can gain and take from nature and apply to our own technology. And for all you people wondering about the Mona Lisa, it was indeed drawn according to the golden ratio. So fun fact for you there. But moving on to something just as beautiful as the Mona Lisa, termites. It's potentially something known to destroy the very foundation of our homes. But could they actually hold the secret to building better and more efficient structures? Dr. Kamaljeet Singh seems to think that they might in their very own termite mounds. So our iScience editor, Priyanka, went on the scene to find out exactly what we can learn from these tiny little architects.
All right. Hello.
Hello.
So today we are here with Dr. Kamaljeet Singh, bringing us some fantastic research about how engineers and architects can take lessons on building self-cooling skyscrapers and all this from termites.
Yeah, sure. For me, it's very fascinating. Yeah.
It's been 1.5 years we've been exploring this. By chance, we just came in contact with biologists who are investigating this problem for a long time. The interest here is because the structure itself, it controls temperature so well, within +/-3°C throughout the day. And it happens, okay, there's some complexities as well, because there are different mechanisms. Different people propose different mechanisms. Why we have interest, because if we learn the mechanism, how they control it, so we can design energy-efficient buildings.
That's quite interesting. So you mean to say that these mounds, the termite nest, the fine architecture that they build, can actually have a huge implication on the self-cooling for engineers, etc.
Yes, indeed, yes. And what we found at the micro scale, they don't build them probably intentionally. It comes by packing geometry of what they collect together. It is packed so nicely that they get benefit out of it.
Wow. Yeah.
Micro scale to larger scale, everything is like contributing to this factor.
And now that you mentioned contributing, I was wondering how many scientists actually put their brain into this? How big a team were you?
In our group, actually, we were doing mostly part-time, working mostly on Sundays, Saturdays. And this team is quite diverse. So we have mathematicians, and I'm myself a civil engineer, and we have a petroleum engineer in it.
Wow.
And there's another mathematician. Then we got two guys from France who are really famous in this field in biology. So this is the beauty of our team, because we have different diverse background but with the same aim, same motive. Yeah.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did this come about? So you were telling me yesterday that this idea came about. How did this idea come about?
We were not drunk when we were talking about it. I was just joking. Generally, people, when they go for conference, they have some drinks and they have our idea together. But this one, in fact, we had somehow fortunately made links to a friend who was there yesterday as well. He worked as a postdoc in France.
Okay.
Then he moved here, and his professor also moved in mathematics department. He was invited to be a professor here. And they've been doing this work for a long time. Not himself, but in biologists there. And they did some imaging 10 years ago, 9 years ago, and they did it. And then later, probably...
Here in Imperial?
In France.
Okay, in France.
And then somehow we did, let's do some Skype chatting.
Okay.
And that's how it started.
Where were you then at the
At Imperial, in
at
science
Imperial,
department,
at
yes.
the science, oh,
at
great.
Science and engineering department. Yes,
oh, great.
Yes. So only there are two guys who are in our team. I never met them.
Okay.
But I know them very well now because of our Skype meetings.
And
we published paper together.
That's quite interesting how the world is getting together.
Exactly,
right?
It's getting connected.
And these termites that you study, there was a special termite as well who use fungus in their...
Yes, there are two types of termite and they make mounds.
Okay.
One type of species, they grow quite large mounds or nests.
Okay.
But they grow fungus, which is very special and very unique fungus.
Okay.
And you can find anywhere in the world. But second, there are smaller nests, which are quite closed. And they don't grow fungus in there.
Yeah.
And if you grow fungus, you have actually contributing more CO2. And then you need to exchange the CO2 as well. But they grow fungus to eat it.
they grew up on the street.
Yeah, there's a cycle there.
Wow. And these are the mounds that he's found in India or Senegal? Which one are these?
There are many different countries you can find.
Okay.
The big ones you can find in India, in Bangalore. Then Africa, you have it.
Okay.
And then Australia.
Wow.
And Brazil.
Wow. So that must have been quite a tour as well while studying them.
So we got samples from our collaborators from France, from Senegal and Guinea, which is in Africa.
Yeah.
But they've been doing this field work in Australia and Brazil. In fact, what our next idea is to do really comprehensive study on field scale studies, collect all the data for temperature, moisture content, wind velocity, because we need this input data for modeling purposes. And then create something very similar stuff in the lab, controlling the temperature very well, precisely, controlling the CO2 concentration precisely, and then checking all the parameters. And then, of course, add it on the computer simulations on it.
And with these computer simulations, how long would you think that it would take to have an impact in architectural or, say, engineering world?
It will take a couple of years before we have something very concrete in hand. So the thing is this, we've been doing this part time on weekends. Our plan is to grow the team and do full-time research into it.
Okay.
Once it's full-time, then it gets momentum.
Yeah.
And then everything comes together, especially with the diverse background, we'll put together everything.
We hope that this research grows and we soon get to see self-cooling skyscrapers, all thanks to your team.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah.
And thanks also for yesterday you came. I hope you enjoyed our...
We did, we did. And I'm sure there was quite a buzz around that stall, actually, where you were portraying the mounds of interest. No, but it was...
The thing is this, people see... I think most of people have seen these ones. But not many people know about this.
Exactly.
And this is the good thing about having public engagements. So people know these things. And also, 90% of people, they don't know they are most of the mites are blind.
Yes, that was actually quite an interesting fact that I myself came to know that termites actually are blind but still can create such architectural marvels.
So there are chemical signals or they can have vibration signals. But this is a really teamwork. There are millions of termites, they're putting everything together.
Well,
and apart from that, we also, after we published this paper, we got calls from Oxford guys. They have very interesting problem, ants problem. And they're looking into ants in Fiji and I think in Germany as well. These ants, they go and hunt around. They go and look for seeds. And there's only 6 types of seed they can look for. And when they find it, they go up on the tree, very high on the tree, and they put the seed on the crack somewhere and plant comes out of it. Generally plants, they have very small stem and then leaves, but these special plants, they have big stem. The stem, actually ants, they know stem inside has lots of holes, a lot of the channels and galleries, and they live it there. They give nutrition to the plant, in exchange they live there, they kill any plants nearby. And this is so smart. And what these guys, they want to know how they control the temperature.
Right.
Because if we know, we can try to think about the same
try to emulate that same thing.
And this is goes into the same, exactly theme.
Yeah.
So we are putting it together, all the efforts together. And maybe we can help them as well.
That's quite nice. So say lessons of teamwork or lessons of the architecture itself. We have a lot to learn from nature, right?
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Well, good luck to you on that.
Thank you very much.
And good luck to everyone in general. So,
thank
nice
you very
having
much.
You.
Bye. Bye.
Wow, so cool. Thank you so much for that, Priyanka. And big thank you to Dr. Kamaljit Singh. That was so interesting. Although I'm pretty salty that a bunch of blind termites can build something cooler than I can, but that's okay. I'll try to get over that. But wow, like the thing that really jumped out at me, I'm not sure about you guys, was just like how interdisciplinary this whole research was. Like, it started off in France and they published a paper by talking about it over Skype and doing it as a passion project on their weekends. Like, to me, sometimes science can just like get bogged down in funding and sticking to your own group and not going out and just staying in your own field. It's so amazing to hear some great research coming from a group of interdisciplinary people.
Yeah, definitely. It feels like what's like science should be. Like people coming together from all walks of life, working on this passion together, and actually getting somewhere which could have real benefit to society.
I feel like, you know, the nice thing about science is really fueled by curiosity.
And so many people are curious about similar goals and similar things. So I think once you get a bunch of those like-minded people together, whether it's on accident or at some sort of conference or, you know, just friends of friends of friends, it works out really well. And all of us benefit.
Yeah, definitely. And I just wanted to also just clear something up for everyone. So I got to talk to the main researcher on this before, and so the first thing that like appeared in my mind when we were talking about the termite mounds is like, wow, like, are all our buildings going to look like termite mounds and have tunnels and have fungus at the bottom? But it turns out it's the most important bit. But no, it's really just about like using the logic and the insulation and kind of the techniques to build like structures which could then be used in buildings. So they're really going to just work up to using it in a bigger context. So I guess that's where the engineers come in and scaling up the technology.
So they don't expect us to build our own buildings like termites.
Oh, yeah. And we also have to be blindfolded to really replicate every single case.
And eat all the fungus. Cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, an interesting question was also raised when we were chatting to the research team was, is the fungus actually also acting as a foundation? Because obviously a fungus can be quite strong and
quite
flexible as well.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, just speaking from a plant person perspective, is a lot of funguses and mosses as well, and plants in general, you know, just a lot of them are used for rooting in soil. So yes. I think it could be
such a good point. Well, yeah, isn't that like what stops erosion?
Exactly. So many cases exactly. So many of like invasive species around the world were originally used to hold in soil for erosion.
Oh, really?
And then they just got out of control.
Yeah. classic Europeans bring in something to be like, it'll fix the other thing.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Oh man. But
so that fungus could definitely be a foundation in that regard.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I really hope this succeeds because my office is definitely not a similar temperature all year round.
I mean, it could be so. Oh, I'm like, especially maybe with like climate change and warming and more unpredictable temperatures, it'd be nice to have a...
And the lack of air conditioning in England.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we should all just have fungus carpet as opposed to like regular carpet.
The absolute dream. Can you imagine just walking like throughout your house on a bunch of fungus?
It's probably really soft.
Yeah. Well, it kind of reminds me of, you know, house insulation between like... Mm-hmm. The wood
really
and
the like cotton candy looking stuff, like very puffy. Yeah,
could fungus be the next replacement? Probably.
Some houses have like rooftop like gardens to like insulate as well.
Oh, I know. I've also seen moss like bath sponge carpets.
Oh yeah.
So like if you step out of your bath, you step on this like carpet that's made out of moss.
And then doesn't your moss like grow? And...
Yeah, exactly. Because
don't your
you
feet
know.
Get like dirty again after getting like clean?
Probably. That's I think okay. That's the only downside.
Feet'll get dirty anyway. It's okay.
True.
Oh man, but like, I still can't believe like something that was just quite funny to me was like termites are known for
destroying houses.
Exactly. But it's kind of cool. We're like. It's a bit ironic, like we're turning it back on them, like, you destroy our houses, but now we're going to use
Thanks
you
to
make
you.
It better.
Maybe this time they won't if we build it using their technology.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's it, house. They're trying to improve it.
Right.
Wow, well, on that note, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you to our amazing panel, to Kenna and Harry. Thank you guys so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thank you to Rena for doing a brilliant job, as always, producing the show. And remember to tune in next week and like us on social media. And please visit our website for more brilliant iScience content.